The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Wednesday, 13th of August, 2008. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, we hear from our correspondents in South Ossetia.
Khali has become a totally Russian militarized town now and is completely controlled by them, and I don't think they're going to be going away very quickly.
And in Georgia.
In the end, you know, the international community didn't come and help Georgia. The Americans didn't do anything beyond condemning Vladimir Putin and this Russian incursion into Georgian sovereign territory.
Back home, ministers want internet service providers to log all our emails and the websites we visit and keep that information for 2 years.
There are 1,093 public bodies, including local authorities, who will be able to apply for access to your data.
The disturbing decline in the British bee population, a third have died in a single year. Plus, the highs and lows of the Beijing Olympics. First, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Georgia and Russia have agreed to an EU-brokered peace plan over South Ossetia. The French President Nicolas Sarkozy and his Georgian counterpart Mikhail Saakashvili have signed a modified version of a six-point agreement endorsed by the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. It says the US has shown its disapproval of Moscow's attacks on its neighbour by cancelling a joint naval exercise. The operation had been set for next week, involving Russia, Britain and France. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the Kremlin's military operations had jeopardised Russia's integration into international institutions. Later, Foreign Secretary David Miliband and his European counterparts will hold an emergency meeting to coordinate an international response to the crisis in Georgia. More on this from our correspondents in just a moment. Confusion and consternation reign at the end of 3 days of power-sharing talks for Zimbabwe. It's amid reports President Robert Mugabe had agreed a power-sharing deal with a breakaway opposition leader. If confirmed, it would exclude Morgan Tsvangirai, the leader of the main movement for Democratic Change. A spokesman for the party's splinter faction denied reports his boss, Arthur Mutambara, had signed an accord with Mugabe, saying it's a lie. South African President Thabo Mbeki, who mediated the talks, didn't comment to reporters. Councils, health authorities and hundreds of other public bodies are to be given the power to access everyone's personal text, email and internet use. Under Home Office proposals, ministers want to make it mandatory for telephone and internet companies to keep details of all personal internet traffic for at least 12 months. It's so it can be assessed for investigation into crime or other threats to public safety. Ministers last night admitted the measure will mean companies will have to store a billion incidents of data exchange a day. The information will also be made available to public investigators across Europe. The Conservatives and Liberal Democrats are branding the measure a snooper's charter. Michael Phelps has swum into history as the greatest ever Olympian. He's picked up his 10th and 11th career gold medals at the Beijing Games, more than any other athlete. This morning he won the 200-metre butterfly and an hour later returned to the pool for victory with the 800-metre freestyle relay team. Even a problem with his goggles in his individual event couldn't stop him from touching first. Our team in China will be updating us on the action in Beijing later in this programme. In this morning's papers, The Times says the ceasefire deal in the Caucasus leaves Georgia and its Western allies weakened. The Independent's calling it Putin's revenge, saying a resurgent Russia has crushed an unruly neighbour, humbled the US and Europe, demonstrating once again it's a force to be feared. The Prince of Wales is warning the development of genetically modified crops risks creating the biggest disaster environmentally of all time. In an interview with The Telegraph, Charles has accused multinational corporations of conducting an experiment with nature which had gone seriously wrong. The invasion of the killer jellyfish is the huge headline in the Mirror, saying unseasonal high winds have swept swarms of deadly Portuguese man-o-war to Britain. It reports a seven-year-old boy has had a lucky escape after being attacked by one in Dorset. The Mail and Express have the same story on a breakthrough in breast cancer. Researchers claim a cheap drug used for treating brittle bones can also help stop tumours growing. The Sun reports on how the daughter of Bob Geldof and Paula Yates has copied them by getting married in Las Vegas. So Bob had only been told 15 minutes before Peaches tied the knot with her drummer boyfriend of just 4 weeks. Many of the back pages say Manchester United are close to signing Tottenham's Dimitar Berbatov. The rumoured price tag on the striker, depending on which paper you believe, is between £25 and £28 million. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
First to Georgia. Britons have been evacuated from Tbilisi. Residents there are stockpiling food and water, fearing the city has been cut off by Russian forces. The United Nations says nearly 100,000 people have been driven from their homes. And British Petroleum has said its oil line running along Georgia's coast will remain shut indefinitely. Another larger pipeline is already shut. Yesterday we spoke to our correspondent Luke Harding, who was caught up in a march in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi.
I just got back from the town of Gori, which was hit by Russian bombers this morning. There's now a huge demonstration going on in Freedom Square in the centre of Tbilisi. There are a whole lot of cars going past. The Georgian national anthem is being played. There must be about 5,000 people demonstrating with Georgian flags. I have to say, I'm not entirely sure what they're celebrating, but I've basically driven back from Gori this afternoon past the road littered with abandoned Georgian military vehicles, which have been sort of left there ignominiously. There are, you know, tanks there covered in leaves with decorated with apples, which the troops had sort of left behind in their haste as they fled. You know, artillery pieces, a couple of vans which have been smashed up. And this afternoon I was in Gori itself, in the main square, where a bomb struck, killing five people, including, I think, several journalists. And I talked to locals about what happened. They basically said that the Russians bombed the hospital last night, the main military hospital. This is before the ceasefire, and then bombed again this morning, the main square, right next to a statue of Stalin. The statue is still standing, but the square is littered with abandoned and broken vehicles with debris on the road. Bodies have been taken away. The person I spoke to, who lived just opposite the square, said that they heard this enormous noise. His windows blew in and he just fled. I met him on the road, stopping for a drink. He just escaped from Gori. When I was there, there was hardly anyone there at all, just a few old people walking in the streets, otherwise completely deserted, but no sign of military activity, which suggests that this sort of ceasefire deal is holding. But, you know, the interesting question is where this leaves Georgia, a country that's basically been further dismembered by the Russian military in the west, in the center, with two breakaway provinces, and also where this leaves Mikhail Saakashvili, Georgia's president, for whom really this must be reckoned, I think, a disastrous misadventure. I know that Mikhail Saakashvili had arranged this rally earlier on outside the parliament building here as a sort of a show of support, really, a show of Georgian nationhood. All the buildings I'm looking at are draped with a sort of white and red Georgian flag, and there's a sort of procession of people around Freedom Square, which is a sort of rather elegant, used to be Lenin Square. This is by no means a huge demonstration. I mean, you know, after this sort of 5 or 6 day campaign, he's managed to muster, I don't know, as I said, about 5,000 people. But my taxi driver, who's not a fan of Saakashvili, was sort of saying, well, what are we celebrating? We've actually lost this war. And I think that's probably right. In the end, you know, the international community didn't come and help Georgia. The Americans didn't do anything beyond condemning Vladimir Putin and this Russian incursion into Georgian sovereign territory. And I think Saakashvili is really a kind of diminished figure whose days in the long run are probably numbered.
Luke Harding in Tbilisi. We can cross now to our correspondent Tom Parfit, who's been travelling with Russian soldiers in Skinvali for The Guardian. He's described what he's seen in the South Ossetian capital.
We've been brought here by the Russians, a Kremlin-organised trip to show off the destruction in South Ossetia. We've come down from North Ossetia, the neighbouring Russian Republic. And we're now being shown around the town, a group of foreign journalists. We're being taken around on armoured personnel carriers, and we've seen pockets of terrible destruction in the city. We've seen Georgian tanks knocked out in the street. We've also visited the main hospital, which is peppered with small arms fire, and the doctors there described terrible conditions they had to work under when Georgian artillery was attacking the town in the first days of the conflict.
You say this was a Russian-sponsored trip. Presumably, would it be fair to say that you are seeing things through Russian eyes at the moment?
I think to some extent, and what is evident, actually, is that there are large neighbourhoods of the town which are still intact. Some of the rather exaggerated claims that the city of Skinvali had been levelled to the ground in the same way that we imagine or that we know Berlin and Grozny were completely ruined. I think we can safely say that's not true, but what we have seen so far is there are small areas where there is very terrible destruction and civilian neighbourhoods in areas where there are blocks where people are living and they're just emerging from their basements now after being in the middle of very heavy fighting.
Bearing in mind, Tom, that you are surrounded by Russian soldiers, Medvedev has said there is a ceasefire. Georgia says Russian jets are still bombing. Can you tell us what the truth is from where you are?
It's very difficult to say from where we are, but what is very clear is that the Russians are very much in control of the city. There is a huge amount of armor here. There are Grad missiles, there are tanks, there are howitzers, self-propelled guns here. There are even Uragan Hurricane rockets, which is a very serious offensive weapon, which may indicate that the Russians are wanting to go further into Georgia. But what is clear here is that Skinnafalia has become a totally Russian militarized town now and is completely controlled by them, and I don't think they're going to be going away very quickly.
And you are about to get back onto the armoured vehicle. Where are you due to go next?
Next, we're going to be seeing, I think, southern parts of the town, which were perhaps affected more heavily by bombardment during the early days of the conflict.
Tom Parfitt. And for comment and analysis, go to guardian.co.uk/Georgia. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, read about David Hare's new play featuring Blair, Lord Levy and Jowl-type characters with the theme of betrayal. Details at guardian.co.uk/culture. David Cameron says, I'm not smug. guardian.co.uk/politics. More expensive sausages help push up inflation to 4.4%. A full breakdown of the economy at guardian.co.uk/money. There's also a story with the headline, Giant Turd Wreaks Museum Havoc. Find out what that's about at guardian.co.uk/world. And if that hasn't cheered you up, there's our daily comedy podcast at guardian.co.uk/Edinburgh.
Olympics 2008 from guardian.co.uk.
This is Ian Pryor at day 5 of the Beijing Olympics. Well, sometime soon we're going to get bored talking about Michael Phelps, but not just yet. This morning he became the most successful Olympian of all time, and it's now 11 golds in total for the man from Baltimore. Today was in the 200-metre butterfly and the 4x200-metre freestyle relay, both of which he managed to break world records. And again, the pool's been extraordinary today. The first four finals delivered world records. Phelps' first one was by a very, very narrow margin, just 0.06 of a second, but the relay was an absolute procession. He swam the opening leg for the US and was so far ahead of the field the race was over at that point.
Ian, it's been another successful morning for Great Britain.
Good start so far, and again it's the women cyclists who provided. This time it was Emma Pooley who took silver in the women's time trial on the roads this morning, and that's to add to Nicole Cook's gold in the women's road race just the other day. Pooley had a great time, finishing 35:16.01 behind Kirsten Armstrong of the United States. Cook came in 15th.
And that followed on, obviously, from a trio of medals for Great Britain yesterday as well.
Yes, a silver and two bronzes for Great Britain yesterday. The silver was from David Florence in the C1 class canoeist yesterday afternoon, and that was followed swiftly by two bronzes in the equestrian events. One of these was quite unexpected, Tina Cook's in the individual category. Tina Cook is only here because both Zara Phillips and Lucy Mugirsma, her former teammates, dropped out before the games. So that's a real bonus for Britain. And they also wrapped up the bronze in the team event.
There's been some concerning news away from the sport this morning.
Well, BOCOG, the organising committee, have been very keen to stress from the start that journalists have absolute freedom to speak to who they want and to go where they like while they're in Beijing, and they claim that applies to both Chinese and Western journalists. But this morning this was very much proved not to be the case. John Ray, who's a China-based journalist for ITV News, was interviewing some protesters in Beijing's Ethnic Minorities Park, which is just not very far from the Olympic venues. There was a Free Tibet protest of some kind going on. And the police intervened at that point. They knocked Ray to the ground, and in his own words, he was roughed up. They dragged me, pulled me, and knocked me to the ground. They then arrested him, put him in the back of a police van where they repeatedly questioned him as to what his opinion of Tibet was. Now, this is very bad news for the organisers because press freedom has obviously been one of the big issues in the build-up to the Games. And like I say, they've been very keen to point out the level of access everyone has to both ordinary Beijingers in or outside the Olympic zone. And they'll be really embarrassed by this. And we're yet to get a reaction from BOCOG, but that'll come in due course.
For the latest reports, medals, tables, pictures and blogs from Beijing, go to guardian.co.uk/Olympics.
I'm Mike Duran. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, the blight of the bumblebee.
Loss of honeybees means there's going to be, you know, less of those fruits and vegetables, and when there's less, there's often an increase in price, so that's going to be a problem.
First, the government wants internet service providers to record and store all websites we visit and all our emails for a period of 2 years. The power of access would extend to police, local authorities and other official bodies. So if an application is successful, a civil servant would be able to know that you've been on the Guardian website today and that you emailed your friend a story from it, either at work or at home. If the plan is instituted, we may well end up paying for the government to spy on us, as the industry could pass on the estimated £100 million a year cost to the consumer. The Guardian's Home Affairs editor Alan Travis explains.
Currently, the government has powers to require telephone companies and internet service providers like BT and O2 to keep and retain all your traffic about the mobile phone calls you make or the landline phone calls you make, and to hold that data for up to 24 months. And in the interests of investigating serious crime, they have to hand that data over to the police or security services. What is now being proposed is that the Home Office is saying that they're going to require internet data, communications data, i.e. the traffic which traces all the emails you've sent, texts you've sent and received, and what websites you've visited for a minimum of 12 months and possibly up to 24 months in the interests of investigating crime. Now, this was implementing a European Union directive, but there's a bit of a backstory there. In the immediate aftermath of the London bombings in July 2005, Charles Clarke, who was then the Home Secretary, went to Europe and argued against a lot of opposition from other European states that this internet communications data should be collected and retained for between 12 months and 24 months. What is unusual in reading the document that came out yesterday afternoon from the Home Office was that we always thought that this was for the purposes of countering terrorism and national security, but on closer reading, and something the Home Office has confirmed to me, that this will apply to all public bodies who have powers under the notorious REPA legislation. That's the 2000 Act, the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, which we know gives local authorities the power to use, for example, CCTV cameras to combat fly-tippers or, notoriously in one case, probably mistaken by Bournemouth, I think it was, or to use CCTV cameras to spy on where families lived to see whether or not they were in the catchment area for a school that they had applied to go to or not. And so therefore, there are 1,093 public bodies, including local authorities, who will be able to apply for access to your data of items of all your internet traffic, whether it be text, emails, or what websites you visited, if they can show they're combating some form of crime.
Not just terrorism, any kind of crime, and this is you, me, and everybody.
That's right, yes. Now, and that's obviously a much wider group than would apparently appear to have been the case in transform the nature of the debate. Some of the examples, I mean, the Home Office said yesterday that they thought this was a vital tool to investigations and intelligence gathering, and it enables investigators to identify suspects, examine their contacts, establish relationships between them, and place them in a specific location at a specific time. So that's all very well and good. And some of the examples they gave were obvious yesterday, such as a child sex offenders who were all logging onto and visiting a particular website which showed pictures of a woman, film video of a woman abusing a four-year-old child, and they were able to trace each of the location of those people who visited the website, and that case is straightforward. But they also gave the example of a woman who had told a friend in an email that she was going to take her own life, and they applied immediately to the company, the email company, to find out the location of where that email had been sent from, so they could go around there and try and persuade the woman not to commit suicide, which is obviously not a crime.
And what about the safety of all this information? The government's record on holding personal information isn't exactly unblemished, is it?
That's true. I mean, we must stress that this information data isn't the content of the emails you've sent or the contents of your texts. You imagine in itself is a huge volume of information and data here. I think one European Parliament report referring to this proposal, I seem to remember, talked about the amount of data involved going back from the Earth to the Moon four times if you stacked it all up one on top of another. And that doesn't include the content of emails or texts. And so that may, we've yet to fight that battle, yes.
But, and this just isn't for the UK. This information would be accessible across Europe, so somebody in Brussels would know that I like visiting estate agents' websites to see what properties I can't afford, for example.
I mean, it's already caused quite a strong debate across Europe. In Bulgaria, there's an uprising amongst the internet and blogging community against this proposal. I think Ireland and Slovakia are both in the process of threatening to take cases to the European Court on this particular directive. It's one which is going to cause a controversy right the way across Europe, as well as having the power to that Bulgarian, German or French police can ask for your internet data meaning records.
The Guardian's Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis. Finally, you're trying to choose a healthy option for breakfast. You're sick of muesli and can't afford fresh fruit at the current prices. What do you opt for? Honey? Well, not if things continue the way they're going, as last year a third of British bees died, and we don't fully know why. Guardian writer and author of A World Without Bees, Alison Benjamin, explains what is known about this phenomenon.
There's a variety of problems that bees suffer from. There's a parasite that lives on them called the varroa mite. Not very pleasant, and it's thought to weaken the honeybee's immune system. And various new types of pesticides that we're using in the environment are probably not helping. Malnutrition from the monocultures, the way we're growing our crops. And there's also a lack of genetic diversity. We're using one particular type of honeybee. So again, not the best way for them to develop resistance against pests and disease.
And is there a particular reason there are more deaths in the north of England as compared to the south of England?
No, it's interesting. I spoke to the British Beekeeping Association about this, that the organisation that carried out the survey, and that they're pretty baffled by this. And what they want is government to do a lot more research into the causes of bee deaths to try and pinpoint some of these issues.
Presumably other governments are looking into this as well, because this is a worldwide phenomenon, isn't it?
That's right. The US, they've lost about 36% of their honeybees this year and about 30% the previous year. And they're putting it down something they call colony collapse disorder, which again means they don't really know what it is, but it's a combination of factors. And the US government is now starting to put a lot of money into researching this, because pollination in the States is worth about $15 billion a year, so it's big business. Over here in the UK, the British government says the pollination by the honeybees for our fruits and vegetables is adding about £165 million a year to the UK economy. So we're not just talking about shortages of honey when we talk about loss of bees, we're talking about possible problems with pollination of our foods.
Well, you say possible problems. Can you expand on that? What does it mean for the pollination of plants if they're not being pollinated?
Well, the honeybee increases the yield of most fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds by about a third. So loss of honeybees means there's going to be, you know, less of those fruits and vegetables. And when there's less, there's often an increase in price. So it's going to be a problem.
And in America, bees are put on trains and shuttled around the country to pollinate plants, aren't they? Is that something we could see here?
We're never going to see it on the same scale as the States. I mean, just the amount of distance they're travelling, thousands of miles trucked up from Florida up to California for the almond pollination of 600,000 acres of almonds in February. Obviously, we don't have that type of land, and we won't see it on that scale. We do have bees trucked around, but only, you know, a few hundred miles in this country.
To finish then, should we end on an apocalyptic quote from Einstein? Can you remind us what that was?
If the bee disappeared off the surface of the globe, then man would only have 4 years of life left.
Oh, well, I made it to 40. I'm happy. All right. Alison, thank you very much indeed for that. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30. Producing today, Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.